Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Hello. Hey, Sonia. How's it going?
It's going well. Going well. Excited to be here. Was really looking forward to this conversation for a while.
Yeah, me too.
Before we get going, can you introduce yourself, please?
So hi, I'm Andrew Harmer-Law. I'm a tech principal at ThoughtWorks. And that means I do loads of different stuff, but pretty much I do like software architecture stuff for clients in different, not all around the world, but all over Europe, doing lots of different things and lots of different projects. So I've been lucky to see a bunch of stuff happening. So that's kind of what's led me to here. So
that is awesome. And of course, congratulations on your new book.
Thanks.
That is an awesome achievement. That is what we're here to talk about today. I will give myself a moment to be a fan and say the blog post that started it all was formative for me. It got me thinking more about how architectural decisions were made. The book had been really, really amazing. I went through it. It is the most in-depth work I've ever seen. I felt like, what am I going to ask about today? But there are a few questions both on and around the book that I wanted to unpack with you. So we can get to it. Maybe start with, how did you get from a blog post to a book? When did you decide to write a book? Was there a moment?
So it's a good question. So I think I'd wanted to write a book for a long time, and I'd been annoying O'Reilly people. So I got feedback from various people who know better that I should have spoken to multiple publishers, but I'd wanted, since I started work in IT at Sun Microsystems years and years ago, before the 2000 and kind of dot-com boom, I saw O'Reilly books and I was like, I want an animal book. So I'd been annoying O'Reilly people at conferences, the people who run the bookstalls and stuff, because they're the marketing people. I'd been asking them how to write a book. And so they told me to kind of send emails to these people. So I pitched a few books. And then meanwhile, I'd been getting frustrated, and we can maybe talk about this. I've been getting frustrated with how me doing my job as an architect was beginning to get in the way more and more, and not necessarily kind of, in the old days, it would kind of make stuff better and make everything work better. And I was realizing that me doing my job was actually slowing everyone down. In COVID, I was really lucky to work with a client who allowed me to do a bunch of experiments, and they're named in the book. So, and actually Pete Hunter, who was the person I paired with at the client, we basically tried a bunch of stuff and a bunch of experiments, and it really worked. So then I got told by the delivery principal, who's like the chief kind of delivery person, ThoughtWorks person, Mel Mitchell, said, you need to write this up. So I wrote it as a blog post, which Martin Fowler put in his blog. But then I kept getting asked questions about it, and I kept trying to do lots of different things and try it with different clients and other thought workers. We try it with different clients, and then people like yourself, Sonia, right? So, because it was on the internet, people could try it. So then it became, and then I was like, this might be a book. So one of the three books I pitched to O'Reilly, two of them they thought were terrible ideas, but this was the one they thought was quite a good idea. So then it became the book. And then it took nearly 2 years to write. So then, so you said it's very in-depth. I think O'Reilly would call it slightly too long, and there was a lot that got cut out, because I had a lot of opinions. So,
I don't know. 2 years to write a book seems about the right time frame for me. But then again, I've never done one. And it is very, very in-depth. There is a lot there, as you just said. So if I were to ask you to extract the most important idea from a book, what would it be?
So the thing I realized, it was important, but I didn't realize how important. And I realize it's important because there's a certain thing that needs to be in place for this to work. And the thing is trust. And so trust is kind of spread throughout the book. And so I kind of knew that, but what was cool about writing the book and is cool about being edited. So O'Reilly gave me an editor, Rita. So Rita would, I'd write something and then Rita would say, well, we need to kind of structure this and that you seem to be talking about trust, or you seem to be talking about a social contract where everybody, you know, we all agree to let everyone work in this way as long as we agree to support, you know, we do, we agree to work in a trustworthy way, and therefore everyone else agrees to work in a trustworthy way too. And then I was in the later chapters and it was all about transparency and kind of helping trust. And then even later, it was about like working with variability. And so I kind of was wrestling with the fact that actually you can't be right. There is no right answer to a software decision. It's like you've just got to do your best and then trust it and then test it as soon as possible. And then you'll get feedback. So all that came in. And then I was speaking to people like Diana Montalian, and Diana was like, that's fine for like a white person, you know, male presenting white person to say all of these things. But what if you're not, right? You know, and then all of these things. So then I was, all of this stuff kind of got baked in, which was like, right, maybe some people are trusted more than others. Maybe some, you know, gray haired, actually white person. So, and I became aware of all of these things. That's where lots of the stuff in the book comes from. But fundamentally, it's all about trust. If you trust each other, and there's lots about how to build trust and to learn to trust each other, then it works. And that's the kind of the central thing. And so there's lots of ways you could fail. So that's in the book too, right? Things to watch out for. So.
Yeah. I'm going to pin that trust question and talk about it a little bit more later, how you get to that really good balance of trust and accountability. But I wanted to come back to the experiments that you ran before you came up with the idea of writing a book about it. As you were writing, as you're thinking about architectural decision-making, changed at all post those experiments? And if it did, how did it change?
Yeah, so this is a really great question. There used to be a lot of footnotes in the book, and many of them got taken out because my page count was too high. But one of the ones that survived, I used to be, one of the things that triggered this book was, I would go in and I would be being paid to be the architect. So, and I was working in Norway before COVID happened. And so one of my jobs there was kind of to go in and do lots of architecture and tell people what to kind of tell people what to do, tell people what the architecture was. And so I would try and collaborate with them and kind of be like a, you know, a hands-on architect, but fundamentally it was me that was deciding. But I was working with a product manager, a thought worker who now isn't a thoughtworks anymore, but a product manager called Manira Raimi. And I would say things very definitely and sound like I knew what I was talking about. And Manira would just go, how do you know? Which is a classic, you know, you haven't, like, it sounds good, but you don't know, right? You haven't tested it. You haven't seen if this will, when it makes contact with the code or with the customer base or with the expected load, like all of these things, you're just guessing. And I was like, oh, crikey, that's interesting. So that was very interesting. And then meanwhile, James Lewis kept telling me to read Don Reinertsen's The Principles of Product Development Flow, which is amazing. And more people should read it, but it's quite thick. But interestingly, you realize underpinning all of that stuff is a lot of stuff about making decisions and driving product. But if you add the word architecture in front of decision, it all completely makes perfect sense. So I just looked at that and read through that all the time. And so that led to my kind of understanding about decisions. The phrase, which there was debate about whether it should stay in the book, but it comes directly from Don Reinertsen, is fast and wrong is better than slow and correct. So, and I think then I then say, this is probably triggering to, you know, because software architects, we spend ages thinking, trying to get the right answer. But when you study, you know, the principles of complex systems and all of this kind of stuff and flow and feedback, there's so much going on in software architecture these days that the far bigger enemy of software architecture is taking a long time to think really hard and find out, even if you get the right answer, maybe it took you 3 months when you could have tried three bad things really fast, learned, and then got to the same place faster, right? So that you know, being able to then split up decisions to understand the relationships between decisions, my relationship with decisions and how that plays into architecture became super interesting. Then I reread bits of A Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander, and then in there, there's a whole thing about like the relationships between patterns, which also works for decisions. And then I reread the blog post that Michael Nygaard wrote, which kind of introduced ADRs, which was a big part of the book. And I hadn't realized there's a single sentence where Michael Nygaard says, the consequences of one decision are frequently the context of the next decision. So I was realizing that there were all of these kind of decisions that were sitting within each other and inside each other. So all of that, which I kind of half gut feel knew, I had to think out loud, express it. Rita then had to tell me it wasn't clear and I'd have to rewrite it. So there's quite a lot of rewriting, which nobody tells you about when you write your first book. Just to kind of get that down. And so my understanding of things has changed fundamentally. So now I worry a lot less about whether it's correct or not. I worry, are the right people involved so we've got the right information? Is it small as it could be so we can learn as rapidly as possible? And have we properly taken into context, into consideration all of the things which kind of surround it? That's far, for me, far more important than let's get the pick the right flavor of Kubernetes or something. So,
wow, okay. Sounds like a lot of crystallization happened as you were doing the research. And the piece that I really relate to is the pairing with a product person. To me, for an architect, it's such a key pairing, and it's almost a force multiplier if an architect is paired with a great product person who can question them meaningfully and say, but what about this?
Yeah, totally. There's another thing that Diana, it's in the book that Diana Montalian says, which is like architecture is always, it depends. The question is, what does it depend on? And lots of the time it's technical stuff, but sometimes we could have three technical, could be technical option A, B, or C, but then the product manager will be like, right, but this maps to the product strategy, which isn't technical. That's like, okay, right? The product manager, if we collaborate with them, they can do it. So now when I'm running this for clients, I'm like encouraging product managers to leave comments and advice on ADRs and stuff, because you can frequently see them where they'd be like, I like option A and B, but C will get us to my product goal faster. Brilliant. Okay, that's cool. Let's do that. So that's a superpower. It's amazing. So
Yeah. So I want to talk about the organizations that have successfully moved to decentralized decision making. And I'm curious, what are the characteristics of those organizations that are able to make that leap? And you don't have to name names. I always like names.
Yeah, I can name two because they're like publicly, I can name the... Yeah, sorry, I'll let you finish. But yes, I could name two.
Yeah. Talk about those. I'm curious, what is a successful, what does success look like? And what do you have to be in order to get to that success?
So the first things that I thought would be necessary for success, but aren't. So I thought to begin with, so this gets thrown at us a lot. There were two things actually. So people go, yes, but your thought works. So that sounds a bit egotistical, but people like, they go, yeah, but you know, you're associated with good software engineering. So therefore, do you need to be like this ThoughtWorks type software engineer? That's completely not the case. There's a quote, which I think I found to put in the book, which is from Reed Hastings, who started Netflix. So someone asked Reed Hastings, you know, where do you find all your awesome engineers? And Reed Hastings said, I hire the people who are upset, you know, like who are frustrated at your company, whoever the person asked him, and they get out of their way. So fundamentally to this is that, again, and it builds on trust, almost every single person I've ever worked with is better than everyone thinks they are, because they're not given the opportunity to ship code or to, you know, to be involved in decisions. Or, and this is the next thing, to be able to fail and learn. So that's the trust thing, but is also safety, right? So it's important for diversity because you get diversity of opinions and diversity of thought, but it's just important for everyone, right? If you think you have to be right first time, then you're not going to really be innovative. You're not really going to do the thing that's going to make a big, you know, you're going to take the safe option. Or you will take the safe option and still fail, but you won't be willing to admit that it's there. So key things that need to be there are kind of like enthusiasm, willingness to participate. Doesn't need to be like a certain skill level. I've tried this with lots of different people. And frequently what's exciting is you'll see junior people will start to kind of step up within an organization, because they'll be like, well, I see this in the code all the time and it annoys me. So, and they'll maybe try and make a decision, or they'll start providing advice against decisions that are happening. And so that's really good. The other thing is there's a later chapter in the book about leadership, because I realized there was one thing I was worried about, and it turns out not to be true. I was worried that maybe this just happened because of my first force of personality. So I was there waving my hands around, but actively not deciding. So I would be like, I'm facilitating, which is the title of the book. I'm facilitating your architecture, but I'm not doing it for you. So my great fear was that maybe it was me dancing around and my enthusiasm, which was causing that. But then other thought workers started doing it. And then even more excitingly, people like J.D. Carlson, who I met in a open space at the virtual DDD community, they said to me, like, well, we're doing this. They'd completely arrived at a similar endpoint with all of the bits glued together from a slightly different angle. So they didn't, you know, my book was just confirming what they'd already figured out. And that was super cool. So they hadn't, you know, from first principles, architecture is hard. We should decentralize it. We should optimize for feedback. We should make small decisions. We should get the right people involved. We should be safe and learn and stuff. They got to the same conclusion I had, but without knowing anything about my blog post or anything. So I was like, okay, this is good. So it's not a factor of my personality, but it does require leadership. But it requires leadership to kind of get out of the hierarchical position and then foster leadership in the small. And so leadership, for example, is stepping up and taking a decision. So therefore, it's creating space for people to lead themselves. It's creating safety for failure. So again, there's a thing in a Reed Hastings book. I think this one's in Powerful by Patty McCord, who's the person who's responsible for co-writing the culture deck with Reed Hastings. Patty was like, if you want to build safety, the easiest way to do it is to model like acceptance and learning of failure from the top. Because people are always like, it's okay if the top fail, because then they can pretend it didn't happen. So there's a famous video of Reed Hastings admits and explains why it was spectacularly wrong to stop shipping DVDs at Netflix, which was a big thing at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's all the kind of the criteria. And then what's interesting is if you have all of that, then you'll end up with a learning organization, but you'll end up with a learning organization which is learning with the architecture that you've got, with the products that you've got, with the skills that you've got, with everything that you've got, right? It won't be like some vanilla flavor that everybody does. It'll come together in the way that you need it. So certain people will teach other people. People will be able to admit when they don't know things and stuff. So that all kind of comes together. And that's super cool. So those are the things I've kind of seen. I've roamed quite wide on the answer. But all of those pieces, it's like if you put these little bits in place, then it turns out you can unlock this latent capability that Reed Hastings pointed out that is already in many, many people. And then you just kind of get out of its way. And that, again, why it's called facilitating software architecture. There's a lot in there that everybody has, but they don't know where to put it or where to express it. So that's kind of the goal of all of this.
Yeah. Wow. So it does sound like it needs a catalyst. It needs a leader to make it happen.
Yeah.
And in that, we're very much in agreement. I arrived some time ago at this idea that really architect's role is a leadership role, even though they may not have a position power, but they do. This is what they have to step into if they want to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So what about the opposite? Have you experienced an organization where you've brought this ideas into and it just failed spectacularly?
So I haven't. Luckily, I haven't, because that would be quite dramatic. But I have this. I haven't introduced this on every single client I've worked with. And the thing that's fundamental, because I spent a lot of time, because sometimes now, because the book's published, people are coming to me going, oh, we're going to do this. And I'm like, well, I'm not sure. But there was one place where I have and where I did work, and the trust wasn't there. And it wasn't because of the individuals, but it was just the way that the people who worked on the systems were structured and everything. It was set up so that there would be so much that would have to be changed that the trust just wasn't, it was never going to be there. It was set up in an adversarial kind of hierarchical way. And so if I'd have tried this, it would have failed badly, and it could have been weaponized, or, you know, there's again, based on Diana Montalian's feedback, I was, you know, she's like, you're still assuming everyone wants this to work. What if there are people who don't want, and there will be, like, so I've got a talk that I did at Newcrafts last year around about like the kind of the fact that the pressures of society and the societal systems impacts on your code. There are people who've kind of built a career on knowing about a bunch of stuff, which keeps them in a job, right? For good reasons or bad reasons. And like Alberto Brandolini calls him the dungeon master, or the famous blog post about Big Balls of Mud talks about swamp guides and stuff. And even if you think about the Phoenix Project, right? Brent, who's not a bad guy, but he's the person who knows, right? So Brent, and everything has to go through Brent. So if you're an architect working for that company, you'd need to speak to Brent because he would tell you how to get to prod, right? So not to say that these people are good or bad, but sometimes they're in a place and they can't let go of things. And so you just, you know, sometimes it's worth checking. What I have done, though, is the way to find out is you can start small. So you can start, if you're an individual architect and you don't know how your organization will react, you can just start trying to do the advice process on your own. So instead of just deciding arbitrarily, you can go and seek advice. So the advice process is anyone can decide as long as they seek advice from people who are impacted, affected, and people who have expertise. So you can model that and say, I'm doing the advice process. I'm still retaining the power to decide because that's how it works. But I'm seeking your advice. I want to know what you think. Or you can be a team, which, you know, in a maybe traditional architecture organization doesn't have the power to decide. The responsibility and accountability for deciding still sits in an architect somewhere, or it's a review board. They can still prepare the decision, write the ADR, collect all the inputs, et cetera, and then say, we are recommending that you do this, that you take this decision, but we know we don't have any power. And then you can build up trust that way. The good thing is, again, channeling Manira, the product manager, if that's going to crash into your culture, you'll crash into it very fast. Don't do this. You can't take decisions. Stop, right? So then you can fail fast. But if it works, then you can maybe do it in a team, or then maybe do it in two teams. So the last chapter is all about, like, don't go big bang. Start small. Find out what your culture is. Find out how you react and respond, et cetera, because it is very simple. The point that there's two core elements. The core elements are the advice process, which is anyone can decide as long as they seek advice, and ADRs, which gives you transparency and history. Because in typical company organizations that use the advice process, they're not deciding about software. So software moves fast. Everyone's working on it all at the same time, and it changes so quickly, you need to have a record. So those are the two things I put together. Everything else is optional, and you end up with other bits. But those are the two key things. And then how those bits fit in your organization will depend on your organization, right? So it wound up Rita a lot because I spent ages saying, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. And Rita was like, but this is a practical book. You need to, people want to be told what to do. And I'm like, I can't tell them what to do because then they'll fail. So there's a lot of me dancing around going, this might be the thing. And here is, this is where all the words come from. Here are some criteria which will help you decide whether or not you need to adopt this additional practice, et cetera. So.
I think that's a really good approach. I tend to agree with Rita. A lot of these types of books, I want to read through them and I want to figure out how to apply it pretty quickly. Otherwise, it's more of a thought experiment for me. So it's good to have those with the caveats that this isn't dogma. Obviously, situations are different. Organizations are different. Pull out things that work for you and here are the foundations that you definitely have to have work out the rest. So I love that approach. So you sound like you've had some very interesting experiences, maybe some scars, war stories. What is one story that you wanted to tell that's not in the book?
Not in the book. There's some really good ones that are in the book. There's ones where I thought I was right and it turned out I was wrong. And that's where Pete gets his biggest mention because Pete. So I sound like a big advocate for this. I was, but until someone disagreed with me, and then I was like, well, let's throw it out the window. It'd be like they can decide whatever they want, but that seems like a really bad idea, so I'm going to tell them to stop. And Pete, and this is in the book, Pete went, well, if you do that, then immediately you've completely undermined, you know, I would have destroyed the trust. So something that's not in the book, I think that's a good one. There's lots of little ones. I've realized, having written a book, that the skill of writing is not just a skill of like communicating, it's a thinking tool. And so there's lots of instances where me trying to write things down and trying to explain things and trying to understand things, and it turns out it's what I've been doing for a long time, I just never realized it. By trying to write things down, you understand what the problem is, or you understand you don't understand the problem, and then you can kind of clarify and crisp it up. So there's lots of times where I've learned, so more than just one story, lots of times where I've been trying to understand something, and by in the process of writing it down, then it's become a lot clearer, or I've realized that I'm, you know, stupid or whatever. And that's something which is kind of scattered throughout the book, but it's like I'm never I think maybe I'm lucky because I work for other for clients and you know, I don't, you know, I move from domain to domain. I'm kind of allowed to be dumb because the client always knows more about their domain than me. But there's lots of, so I've done stuff in electronic vehicles. I've done stuff in Bitcoin. I've done, you know, so Bitcoin, I had no idea. Loads of stuff I just didn't know. But it's quite nice to be able to say, blah, blah, blah. You know, is this right? The other thing is I've learned that being an architect, whether you like it or not, even if you're not, you know, an old white person with gray hair, you'll still, people will trust what you say, even if you don't know. So the other thing I've learned is it's very good to kind of put in place to say, I don't know if this is correct, but, and then you will get, because we work in software, everyone loves to tell you that you're wrong. So then you can trigger people into like their like kind of geek nerd, well, actually-ness. You can trigger that into getting them to help you write a better blog post, or not blog post, ADR, sorry. Also, it does work for blog posts. And that's a super, like, if you can trigger, but for the forces of good, not the forces of evil, the, like, all of the kind of, well, actually-ness of software engineering and architects, it's amazing. And then suddenly, three or four or five, six people are writing this ADR, and it's not just me. I'm more, again, I'm facilitating it as opposed to actually doing the work.
Yeah, there's so much truth in writing as a crystallizing and activity and clearing things up. I think I need to bring you in to talk to engineering teams and say, write things down, write things down. It can't all be in your head. No, that's great. I want to zoom in a little bit on advice process. Mm-hmm. So it combines this fast autocratic process of decision making with a more decentralized consultative process. So what do you do with the more authoritarian types, either overriding the decision or maybe the decider avoiding responsibility at the end of the day going, no, I got bad advice.
That's a great question. So the key thing is, and this is, again, there's another book which I'd read, which has nothing to do with the advice process. I realized when I was writing all of this stuff and trying to explain things that it became relevant. So there's a book by Shoshana Zuboff, which is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. So it's not about architecture. It's about like how the argument is like Google, et cetera, kind of, you know, the there's value in knowing what you spend time on and what you do. And so there's an argument that runs through Shoshana's book, which is it's not just important to know who decides, but it's also important to know who decides who decides. And so that's the key thing that flips everything. And there is bits about this in the book because I knew people would be like, well, hold on. Like you said, the decider can be autocratic. That's kind of the point. You, the person who's taking the decision, whoever's decided to take the decision, is obliged by the social contract, right, the trust, to seek the advice. But they can completely ignore it. They have to listen to it. And when you use ADRs, people write it down. So therefore, it's recorded as advice offered by, you know, this. I was going to decide because I'm the author of the ADR, right? So it's me. I write the body of the ADR, I write the context, the title, the decision, various options. But then below it, you keep the advice. So you can see who I asked and what they said. On the advisor front, if I'm ignoring people, what is polite, because I'm British, what I advise in the book is like, if someone has offered advice, but you think you're going to ignore it, you should say, despite the fact that so-and-so recommended I did this, I'm still going to make this decision. So then you're kind of taking responsibility for the fact that, you know, whatever. And it then drives towards people to kind of go, right, why, to get deeper into the advice to say, why does this, you know, for example, I ask advice, what programming language should we use? And someone says, don't use Java. If I go into Java and say, right, why do you think we shouldn't use Java? And they can give me reasons. Then I can say in the ADR, I'm ignoring this advice because that advice was about Java 8 and now Java is Java 21 and everything has changed. There's new GCL, you know, it's not slow or blah, 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 all this stuff. So it drives more detail, more context and better decisions. Also, like you said, the kind of the check to the fact that your name is on the authorship is aligned very much with Open Group's approach to architecture. So they used to state that, you know, there should be an architectural group of people and those people should have responsibility and accountability for decisions. So that's why it worked, but it was always a bottleneck because it would have to go through these named group of people. In the agile version of the Open Architecture Framework, the OAA, they say as long as accountability and responsibility, so like me taking a decision and me being accountable for the decision are in the same place, the same human being or team, that's fine. So then you write it down in the ADR so a team can decide, but then they're responsible for it. or an architect can decide, but they're responsible for it. And the fact you have this permanent record of like immutable ADRs, which is a trail of decisions, I think the section in the book is called A Check to the Reckless, because I've yet to see someone take a completely reckless decision knowing it was reckless or bad or it would have a big impact, because they know that it's going to be there, right? Publicly, on the intranet somewhere, intranet somewhere. So if someone comes back and goes, who made this decision? Well, it turns out it was Bob. Bob did this. You know, Bob wrote their name against it. So that's good. But like you said on the other point, the autocratic thing, it is hard, and there is a whole chapter on like how to emotionally let go of things. And like I said, there's a story where I couldn't let go. So the kind of the core story is, you're right, it is hard. It is hard to watch a team potentially screwing up. But the point of that, my story there was, they didn't screw up. I was wrong and they were right. And you can't see the future. You don't know if you're right or wrong until you've, like you said, Sonia, right? Until you've coded it up, you've put it into prod and you've learned from feedback. So you can't tell, right? So learning that and going on this journey as a person who used to have power, who is beginning to share that power, or the opposite journey, which is someone who isn't used to it, so now needs to take more, you know, care about their steps and, you know, think about the consequences of things. Both of those are baked in, but it is a journey, right? That's, again, that's where trust has to, like, you will start with a probably an organization, in most organizations, that is capable of trust, but the way we organize is means it isn't there. So you slowly build it up. You do one team at a time or whatever. Mm. And then you'll see it evolve, which is cool.
Wow. I think journey really does describe that. Shifting gears a little bit. So I love all the conversation about biases, especially framing effect. This was actually one that I learned from one of the best bosses that I had, who said time and time again, don't let a good crisis go to waste. And originally I was like, what does that mean? And then I realized, oh yeah, this can always be an opportunity. How do I take that as an opportunity and use it? What was some of the dramatic perception shifts that you've observed due to framing bias in reframing things for people?
So I think someone I've already mentioned, actually, is a really good question. One is the architects, that you need to make the best. Like, I get this. This is a talk. I'll rewind. I'm going to write a talk this year called How to Make the Perfect Decision. Brackets. There is no perfect decision. But I don't know. Maybe it's because of, like, so I say in the books, I'm autistic. So I'm very aware that certain people of certain types drift towards software because it's, you know, it's very ones and zeros. It's binary. You know, it's like the code compiles or it doesn't. It runs in prod or it doesn't. But that seems to have spread into the complex socio-technical world, where we just think that because we can control the small things, we assume we can kind of be right and correct about the bigger stuff. And that might have, I don't think it ever was, but it might have been more possible to be correct in the past. But now with microservices, the cloud, loads of stuff is not in our control. But I still think lots of us labor under the fact that we can think really hard. And if we think really hard, we'll be right, and then it'll work. And that's the biggest shift, which then goes to small and fast is better than – sorry, fast and wrong is better than slow and correct. Mm. That's big. Like, people do get triggered by that sentence, and like I say, quite a few of my colleagues get triggered by that sentence. But it's really, really true. And then it focuses your architecture because you – and that – you know, so then you get this kind of knock-on effect of big realizations and framings. So – you learn, if that's good, then you're like, okay, cool. So we should optimize for flow, which means we should architect for flow, which also means we should optimize for smaller decisions. So you architect for smaller decisions. And just all of, the triggering thing being, it doesn't matter if I'm wrong, but as long as I'm learning and I'm optimizing for learning and finding and evolving. And, you know, like I know from chatting to Neil Ford, there's a bit in the book again about the evolution of systems, right? Because even if we design it, even if we're very, very good and we design everything right and it's perfect, it'll only be perfect for 6 months or 3 months. You know what I mean? Then something will happen and it'll be wrong and we'll need to change things. So that kind of cascade of framing changes and things, and then watching how that changes how people think about teams, about how the organization is structured. So I've seen, there's another mention in the book about Vanessa Formicola, one of my ex-colleagues. She has social decision records. So if a team's deciding that it needs to, you know, change which bits of the microservice it owns, they were like, why can't we also decide whether we split as a team? You know, we don't need to wait for someone else to do that, right? We'll do that ourselves. So then she's brought in this kind of idea, and there's a blog post in, which is linked to from the book again, which is like, well, let's just, you know, start doing that. And that's the kind of stuff that Matthew Skelton and co, Manuel Pais and Team Topologies are beginning to talk about now, right? Trond Hjortland's talking about it too. If you're designing the system, it's a socio-technical system, right? It's not just a technical system. So slowly the edges kind of blur and stuff, and people are like, oh, it shouldn't be someone else. Like Michael Nygaard said, I've got loads of these good quotes, but Michael Nygaard said, your HR department does the first draft of your architecture because of Conway's law. And it's right. But why can't you do the second draft, right? Like nobody's, it's just a human being who said that you're in this team and you're in that team. So you're a human being. So to make a decision based on good rational thought and propose it to whoever can decide, right? So
I think this is the ultimate in self-organizing teams and a lot of what Agile has, I think, originally intended. Unfortunately, there are times that when I've encountered where people actually don't give it much thought, engineers don't give it much thought. I think the biggest example of this I've seen is somebody told me, well, it's really arbitrary and not really critical which team I'm on. And I thought, no, it's very, very critical. And
especially if they start to realize that they can, then you're like, oh, okay. And then some people don't care. They just like being told what, you know, not told what to do, but they like someone. I think, again, as in the book, it's like you're not obliged to decide. You just have the opportunity. So it's not everybody can do architecture. It's anybody who thinks they want to. Some people are happy. They go where they, you know, they turn up, they get given a user story, they build it, and they like running their code. But other people are kind of pushing. They're like, no, but I've got, I don't agree. That's wrong. We can make this better, which is a very, again, software engineer, architect-y type thing, right? And if you can give them this measured, careful way of doing it, you can, those people who are always more than not, like, I'm always surprised, is like the people you think that person's definitely going to have opinions. But there are people who are just below the surface who also have opinions. And then when they step up, then people below them are like, oh, that person, I have an opinion too. Maybe I'll. So it's super cool. This is why I love doing it. It's super cool because, and I get to do it for lots of clients. You'll see these people kind of emerge. It's very, very exciting. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll ask one last question and I'll talk about, we'll switch to psychological safety. You talk about that a lot for those, yeah, how important it is for those that are gaining power in decision-making, for those that are losing power, giving up power in decision-making in this decentralized system. So how do you balance creating this type of psychological safety for everybody, but balancing that with accountability, especially when decisions have big consequences, which I've seen decisions with very big consequences.
Yeah, it's a good point. So this is, again, that's another cool thing about this approach. So there was a client where I did this and they were like, that's fine, but everyone will talk, but nobody will want to kind of make the decision, right? So they just thought it would become a talking shop. And it was a very valid criticism, which I was quite concerned would actually turn out to be true. But the reason it didn't is because, and again, it might be product management, but or it's just generally the organization or the business. There's a force which is behind, which is like, we need to build the thing. We need to do the decision. We need to, you know, the software needs to evolve or be updated or whatever. So that kind of like pulling force, which is the same force, you know, it's not just kind of pulling and like, you know, you need to ship product or whatever, but even if you're not, right, even if you're just maintaining stuff, there's a force that Simon Wardley kind of identifies, and it's even there actually in Christopher Alexander, that things, because you're living in them and they're existing in the world, they're changing, right? So even if your thing is stable, you're still on a very slowly moving conveyor belt, right? So if you're in Java 8, you're in Java 8, you're in Java 8, you're like, if you do nothing, in 5-10 years' time, you're on Java 8, which is not the same as being on Java 24 or something, right? Mm-hmm. So there is this force that's pulling things along. And so psychological safety is important. Like you want people to have all of these kind of things, but it's safety in the context of building a product and maintaining a product and kind of, I don't know how to write this book, but I keep trying to convince other people to write this book. There's something around about like existing in, this had to get cut from the book, but there was loads of stuff in Christopher Alexander's book about you use architecture patterns, right? And you build a house, but then the house evolves and grows and changes and stuff based on the people who live in it, right? rather than architects, I think we're like people, especially developers and architects, but especially developers. We live in the code base, right? So us trying to make that more habitable and kind of evolve it and grow it as tools grow and like, you know, in a house, there might be a new way of like tiling your floor or heating your home or whatever, right? So you would want to kind of bring those things in. With us, there might be a new way to do deployment or a new way to test something or a new, you know, a new feature in an updated version of the language. Those things would kind of come in and bring stuff up. So that plus the psychological safety to make maximize the sensory area, right? You want as many people in the team to be able to think as creatively as possible, to be aware of those things, right? And to bring them in and to say, oh, I'd like to think about this. And I talk a little bit about the safe way of bringing things in as a spike, right? So a spike is like an ADR before it's an ADR. You want people to experiment and learn and fiddle around and try things based on making their part of the system hospitable. So I think that if you have that and you nurture that and you're like, you're looking out for how many different people are proposing ADRs, how many, what is the type, where are the level of ADRs? Are they small? Are they big? Are they blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. Then you can kind of look out for it and then you can support it when you see it. So you'll see a person in a team, which isn't, you know, this isn't going to change the face of the product, but they've got an idea to do a thing. Nurturing that is as important as nurturing the big decision from the big person and the big, you know, the important team. Because people then realize that it's their code base as opposed to a code base that they're just renting or something. And their product, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes a big difference.
All right. Well, thank you for this. This has been amazing to talk to you. I learned a lot from the book. This conversation had just added so much color to this. I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, no, the questions were amazing as well, Sonia. Thank you very much for right. It was lovely to speak about it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.